I'm David Schreiner Khan, and this is Smashing the Plateau. No matter how successful you are, there's probably at least one area where roadblocks are keeping you from fully achieving your goals. Fortunately, you've come to the right place. Every expert I interview on this podcast is different, but they all have one thing in common. They know how to fix problems that keep people stuck. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Cort Dial. When Intel, Chevron, U.S. Borax, Disney, Apple, and other organizations want to cultivate a new breed of leader, they turn to Cort. By guiding individuals through frank self-evaluation, personal change, and the pursuit of extraordinary performance, Cort creates all-in leaders, high achievers who recognize the power of human connection, using his method, Heretics to Heroes. Cort lives in Austin, Texas. Cort, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on.
Thank you, David. Thanks for having me.
So, Cort, what is all-in leadership?
All-in leadership is a form of leadership I've developed over 30 years of coaching leaders, and it basically is a collection of characteristics, realizations, and abilities that are unique to an all-in leader. And what makes an all-in leader special is they can evoke from their people a level of intention and effort well beyond the norm that people get from day to day to get a good job rating and keep their boss happy. And they're also able to focus that energy, that effort on a very big game, I call it. Bottom line, they're able to produce results that heretofore has been deemed impossible to produce.
And so what are those characteristics?
They're aware. They know who they are. They're very purposeful. They know why they exist. So they've done a lot of introspection of why am I here and what am I here to, what's the role I play in this world. They're extremely passionate. They know what they care about and what they care about most. Very adventurous. They love to play a big game. They don't want to waste their time playing a small game. They want to go for the big game. Very clear on what they want to make to happen. So they're very intentional people and they're very courageous. They're able to act on intuition and without evidence that says they're going to succeed.
The last point, being able to act on intuition without evidence that they're able to see. When I hear that, sounds to me like that could be pretty scary.
Sure it is. Yeah. That's why I describe that as being courageous. It takes courage to be an all-in leader. It's a leap of faith, and it's often a leap of faith that your people can pull off what I'm getting ready to invite them into the big game I'm getting ready to invite them to play. So an example of that, I was recently working with a drilling company, and as you're probably aware, the oil industry has hit a big challenge with oil prices, and his organization wasn't anywhere close to being profitable anymore. And everyone in his organization, including himself, believed it wasn't possible to be profitable at $40 a gallon. But I coached him, and he ultimately put in front of his people a challenge, and that is we're going to deliver every well we drill on budget, on time, the first time, and we're going to meet our budget, and we're going to be profitable. And by developing himself and the way he leads, changes the way he leads, bottom line is they've done that for 18 months, and they actually not only profitable, they cut about $800 million out of their budget by doing that. By the way, no one in the industry in the Gulf of Mexico has ever gone a year delivering every well on budget on time the first time.
Wow. So this is pretty remarkable. It sounds like a huge game changer.
Yeah, it's all about how do human beings make the impossible possible? What is it that all these leaders through history have done? What is it they know? Who are they? And what is it that they can do that have caused them to be able to really create an entirely new future, whether we're talking about, you know, Gandhi or Jobs or Galileo. And one of the things they've all done is they are willing to risk everything and play a very big game and put that in front of their people and enroll their people in, hey, sign up with me and we're going to go do something no one else has ever done before.
So why don't more people do this if the results are so remarkable?
Well, one of the things that limits results is what we can see as possible. And very few people have been taught, how do you open up possibility? We're all taught to deal in this world we call of reality. You know, what's real, what's possible. If you can't measure it, you can't manage it. All those things limit our thinking. So we're limited by our experience in our past. One of the reasons I called the book Heretics to Heroes is heretics are these very unusual people. I call them time travelers. They can somehow go to the future, spend some time there and come back and tell us what it's going to be like and how it's going to be better. If you look at all those people I just mentioned, Gates and Walt Disney's one of all these different people, they could envision a future that was much better. And they could articulate it in a way that enrolled other people, and other people say, hey, I want to be part of that. As a matter of fact, I want to be so much a part of that. I'm willing to change the way I think, the way I act. I'm going to learn some new things. I'm going to interact in new ways. Very few people have ever been taught how to do that. So that's why very few people do it.
Now, does it make a difference, Court, whether a leader who is playing a big game and taking on this kind of all-in leadership role is new in an organization, or whether that person has been in the organization for a while?
Well, it's obviously easier for someone who's in an authority to develop themselves and have an effect on an organization. But the all-in leader, and especially the heretics, can come from anywhere in the organization. One of the things I do coach the leaders I coach on is know your heretics, know them and grow and develop them. And they usually exist on the edges of your organization. They're usually people who really don't have a lot at stake in the way things are done today. So often they are new people. Often they are the younger people. I was coaching an organization recently where a young engineer knocked on my door and office door, and he said, hey, I need some help. I have an idea that can save this organization. But my boss has told me to shut up and don't talk about it anymore. He doesn't want to hear it. What does I do? And I had a series of conversations with him. And long story short, he's now leading the most important project they have going on in that organization. This is a large petrochemical company. And he's a young kid, but he's leading that whole effort. Now, his leadership had to coach him and learn to support him in a way where they could put him in that position. But he's a true heretic. And there's a lot of people in the organization don't like what he's doing. And it's being a heretic's not always a popular position, and it's often a lonely position. But he's totally committed. He's all in his idea, and he's been able to enroll the leadership to support his project.
So what I'm hearing that's necessary is a combination of identifying who the heretics already are inside your organization and the current leadership being willing to nurture them and maybe take some risks at having them lead the charge based on their ideas.
Yeah, everyone who plays this type of role in their life or in an organization, we've all seen movies about this. You have this young person with unbelievable ability, new ideas, a different way of doing things. Almost always there's a guide figure that supports them. You know, in Star Wars, you have Luke Skywalker and you have Obi-Wan Kenobi. Well, this young engineer, after he convinced me I'm all in and this is going to happen regardless of the circumstances, I will make this happen. Once he was willing to commit that to me, his first task was go find his Obi-Wan. And he ended up going to a senior manager in the organization about four levels above him and sat down with him and said, I have an idea that can save us. And I'd like you to become my sponsor and be my coach, be my mentor. So step one for most heretics is go find a mentor who's in an influential position who can support you.
And what's step one for the current leadership if they find that they're at a plateau and they're not sure what to do about it?
Well, I'd say if you want to improve performance, the only leader's got to change is you. So the top person at the top of an organization, I'll sometimes refer to them as the big wheel. If you have a series of wheels stacked on each other and sequentially they get smaller from top to bottom, when the big wheel at the top moves in any direction, the ones lower down in the organization spin like crazy. So the first thing to do is recognize that if I want to change performance, if we're stuck, what needs to change is me, not my people, not my systems, not my programs. I'm very often brought into organizations and I run into a leader whose whole approach is, I want you to come in and help me fix my people. And the first conversation I have is nothing needs to be fixed around here and no one. But what needs to change if you want to improve performance is you. Are you willing to go there? Are you willing to have that introspective exploration of yourself, inquiry, and develop yourself into a leader that can produce the level of performance you're seeking?
And what kind of answer do you typically get?
Why me? Why does it have to be me? Why do we have to play a big game? Why why can't we just improve some systems and programs? And my answer is well, I got two answers. One is you're not going to get the level of performance unless you develop yourself and change. And secondly, I don't work with people other than people who want to work on themselves. I'm not interested in coaching someone who's going to go the systems behavior route when there's much more powerful and effective and efficient ways to produce performance than to buy some new equipment or put in new programs. I mean, we just pile program after program and system after system on people, assuming that they're going to make the difference. And most systems aren't followed. Most procedures aren't followed. Most rules are broken by people every day in organizations. The way work gets done in organizations is typically through social agreements, social covenants they have with each other. But most leaders don't know how to affect that. So what they go to work on is write some new procedure, bring in some new program, put another system on people.
What's a good example of working on the social piece?
Well, I'll give you the first time this dawned on me. I was in Old Navy with my 5-year-old son, and we were buying him some clothes. And he was watching the person at the register take all the security devices off of his clothing as we're checking out. And he looked up at me and said, "Hey, Dad, what's all that?" I looked down at Charlie and gave him this long explanation of the whole system, the whole program, all the different equipment and the cameras and the towers out front at the entrance. And when I got all done, he looked up at me and said, "Why don't they just teach people not to steal?" And it dawned on me, why do we waste all this time and energy on systems and equipment, where if we all would just socially get together and reach some agreements, we could perform at a much higher level at a much more efficient and much reduced cost. So an example in business is walking into an organization where they want to improve safety performance and they're hurting a lot of people, they're killing people. And typically what the leader will do is say, "We got to figure out how to make these injuries go away, or we need to reduce our number of incidents and injuries 20% next year." And the problem with all that is, one, is people don't enjoy and get excited about making go away what they don't want to have happen. People enjoy bringing into being something they're excited and committed to. And then secondly, that isn't a big game, reducing injuries 20%. So the first step is the leader has to envision a future and articulate that future in a way and put that in front of them and their people and invite them in to join me, and we're going to create this future for this company. Unfortunately, most leaders have never been taught how to vision, and I'm not talking about writing one of these vision statements as we want to be the undisputed leader in our industry or anything like that. I'm talking about Dr. King's I Have a Dream or Kennedy's We're Going to the Moon. I'm talking about a 2-page letter that's written to employees, put in front of employees and saying, "I'm inviting you to join me and create this future I've articulated here."
Now, I know you have a personal story about safety that's in your book. I wondered if you could just touch on it, because I think it really illuminates what you've just described.
Can you remind? I have several in the book about safety. Can you?
Yeah. The one that involves why did we kill this man?
Oh, that was a significant emotional event that happened to me and a lot of people. So essentially, I made decisions and choices that put a man in a position that got him killed. And our plant manager got us all in a room and had us explore how did we kill this man. And I literally held what was left of this man's hand as he died. And it was a very traumatic experience for me. I was in my early 20s. And I ultimately came to the conclusion we killed this man because I killed him because I didn't see him as worthy of my concern for his safety. He was what we called a contractor. And I didn't even concern myself with his safety when I put him and his coworkers in a position that was going to get one of them killed ultimately. It was only a question of when, not if. And I had to look at myself and say, that's who I am. I'm a person who doesn't even consider a person's well-being before I assign them work. And out of that, I developed a commitment. And the big game I play in my life is I'm committed to the health, safety, and well-being of the men and women who design, build, operate, and maintain the world. The men and women who get it done every day, whether they're engineers or they're janitors, or they're men on a project who are digging a hole with a shovel. I'm committed to those people.
Yeah. Now, and once you made that commitment, What changed? What was the outcome? What was different?
Well, if you can, we circle back to the characteristics and all in leader. I got real clear on who I am, what my purpose was, the big game I was playing. And so what changed for me was I'd always thought improving performance was an incremental thing. Let's continuously improve. That's what we are all taught in my generation as an engineer. And I started to realize that, you know, that paradigm doesn't work when it comes to taking care of people and harming people at work. You know, incremental improvement is wonderful, but people are dying along the way. We're going to have to figure out a way to do what we do without harming anyone. And so it just changed the whole game I was playing and my whole relationship to performance, whether it was quality, safety, or productivity. I stopped being about incremental improvement when I started asking myself, how do we perform at a level we don't even believe is possible? And that started a whole journey of mine that I've been on for 30 plus years trying to answer that question, and which has ultimately ended up with me developing this form of leadership I call all-in leadership.
And based on what you've seen over your career, what do you think successful companies do to smash the plateau that others aren't doing?
Well, many of them have a genuine, and I use the word genuine because most companies aren't genuine. They have a genuine intention to grow and develop extraordinary leaders. You know, most companies, and I tend to work in larger organizations, but most of them just send people off to leadership courses and assume that, you know, somehow they'll acquire something that'll make them a better leader. But that isn't what grows leaders. What grows leaders is there has to be three things, I believe. There has to be a huge challenge. There has to be something that tests this person. You know, I say, you know, the Civil War made Kennedy or made Lincoln, the Civil Rights Movement made King. That's what made these people leaders. So leadership has to put their people in positions that challenge their ability to lead, while at the same time, they need to be taught and learn all the things you need to know, all the things you need to be able to do to be a certain form of leader. My form is an all-in leader. And then I say you need a coach. You need a guide to help you, that person along, and even at times step in and help them in a very direct way as they're learning and growing and developing as a leader, as they're overcoming this enormous challenge they've been given. You have those three things. Those three things sort of tend to form a leader, mold a leader.
And Corey, I'm assuming that you're talking about not just the top leader or maybe the top tier of executive leadership in a big company, but I'm assuming you're talking about all kinds of leaders throughout the organization.
Yes, it could be the top leader, or it could be that young engineer I mentioned who's now, he's facing the challenge of everyone in the organization knows he's helping save this company. He's helping save us. That's a huge challenge for a young man who a year ago didn't know how to tell his boss, how to enroll in boss in his new idea. And was basically, had already almost given up. I was his last resort when he came to me and said, I need some help. I know I can save this company and no one will listen to me.
How important do you think it is to create a culture of learning throughout the organization to support this the concept of all-in leadership?
I think it's very important. Learning always has to be focused on the mission. It isn't just learning for its learning's sake. So when I work for a big corporation, I was allowed to go to two seminars, courses, whatever you want to call them, every year. So you would think the company was committed to learning, but there was no purpose for the learning. It was just check your two boxes on
the form.
Right, on my performance review form. So what did I do? I picked them based on the weather. You know, when I lived in Michigan, I went to Florida to enjoy the summer, you know, or enjoy the warm weather. Not develop. I wasn't going to that seminar because I need this to overcome this huge challenge that I've been given by the organization. So if the learning isn't in support of the mission or the vision or some huge challenge, it isn't worth a whole lot. The thing that I've seen is that people view learning as lessons learned, learning from their mistakes. They have these lesson learned systems where all these different ideas goes into the computer and database, which, by the way, no one ever pays any attention to. And And but to me, learning is learning about myself, about other human beings. What is it that makes us tick? What is it that I, is it this tool I have? I often tell leaders, the best tool you have for creating performance is sitting in your chair right now. That's your best tool. For me, the most important learning when it comes to leadership is, how do I use this tool called me to inspire others to give well beyond what they would normally give to any organization? And how do I do that in a way and focus that on a big game that we're all, our hearts and minds are all around?
And what's an example of a situation where you've seen that that kind of learning takes place with everybody who's in the organization, not just the people at the top?
Well, when I was overseas years ago, I had a project in the Middle East. And in those days, there was no, the concept of safety or productivity didn't even exist. It was basically human beings were used like tools. You hurt one, kill one, you throw it away and bring in another. And through that whole project, what we learned was how to use caring and love and concern for human beings to get everyone to care about each other in a very intimate way, very profound way, and care about what we were there to do. And essentially what we were going to do is we were going to redefine how construction workers are treated and live in the Middle East, because the way we felt the way it was being done was basically immoral and inhuman. And we're going to learn how to do that in a way where we perform at a level that's never been possible in the Middle East. And possible without systems and programs, because we didn't have time. When you build a new chemical plant, you don't have time to write procedures and all that, and they didn't have any. You don't have time to train people. These people couldn't wear safety shoes because they'd never worn shoes in their lives. You know, at best they had sandals. So we, as a leadership team, said, we're gonna do this. We're gonna do it on time, on budget, on schedule, and we're not gonna harm a single individual. We don't have a clue how we're gonna do that, but we are gonna make this happen. And it was mostly learning about ourselves and how do you interact with people in a way? How do you treat people in a way where they will give you everything you want when you put it in front of them, including the performance? So everyone in that project knew we were going to complete this thing on budget on time the first time, and we weren't going to harm a single individual in the process. And when you put that type of a challenge or goal or vision in front of a group, it forces them to have to grow and develop and learn, instead of let's all go to a course and learn how to, you know, do crane safety or how to lead.
Yeah, because if you don't have respect for one another and listen to one another, you're not going to be able to accomplish what you've just described.
Correct. And you know, my experience, and I've been around, in business for 40 years, is what drives most organizations and most performance is fear of failing, fear of upsetting the boss, fear of getting a bad rating,
fear of getting blamed.
Right. And if you can somehow replace that with love and concern, and concerning is what's driving everything going on in this organization, you know, the sky's the limit when it comes to performance. And the project I mentioned, they worked over 8 million man hours, and not a single person had to leave the project for any medical attention. And they were well ahead of schedule. They earned all kinds of bonuses. And it was by far the most successful project in that company's history.
Which is proof that it can be done.
It can. And what was funny is they came to audit this project about halfway through, and they couldn't figure out how we were pulling off this miracle. And the audit team leader got in front of all the supervision leadership, said, we can't figure out how you're doing it. Everything's the same as our other project. You got the same equipment. You got the same, you know, policies and things. And one of the supervisors stood up and said, you're looking in the wrong place. What's different is me. What's different is us. And the audit team leader said, well, what's different about you? And he said, you know, I'm a great constructor. I'm a wonderful supervisor. But on this project, I'm much more than that. I'm a father. And that was really the whole tone of that whole project. And he in a very short phrase, I am a father, basically summed up what was learned on that project, that if you love and care for your people, take good care of them, they will give you and produce results that, you know, beyond your wildest dreams.
And I think we all know of organizations that have created that kind of culture and can relate to it. And we know what a difference it makes and how it really sets them apart from other organizations. Those are the organizations that people want to go to work for. Those are the organizations where people inside will will give their all to try to get things done.
And it's easier than it seems. You know, I've whittled it down to basically five conditions that if you can create these, people will give you their maximum effort and intention toward your mission. And they're very simple. One, we talked about a big game to play. Another one is a sense of belonging, that I matter and what I'm doing here matters. We talked about another one, opportunities for growth and development. One we haven't talked about is people's self-image, the self-image of the organization, what they hold as possible, and the self-image of the individuals, what they believe they're capable of and what's possible. No organization, no individual can outperform their self-image. So you have to put a lot of time and effort in affecting and evolving people's self-image. And then the last one, they have to have commitment to and confidence in victory. And that comes from having a leader who never wavers, and everyone gets that they fully embody what they're asking us to do. You create those five conditions, it's amazing what the performance you can get. And it's not just safety performance. In any area, you can get extraordinary performance because you now have people that are what I call followers. They're devoted to you, and they're devoted to the movement that you're inviting them to join.
Yeah, and I know you do a great job in your book of illuminating what those five different points are.
Yeah, the book, I tried to describe for people in the book, I call it like a nonfiction novel, but I tried to describe what it looks, feels, and sounds like when you're in the presence of an extraordinary leader or a leader going through this development and process of becoming an all-in leader. So it isn't a how-to book. It's more of a what's it look and feel and sound like when this happens type of book.
Cort, whom do you know personally who's been successful at smashing plateaus?
One gentleman who I feel comfortable saying his name is Marcel Robichaud. He's a general manager in Chevron, and he's actually the individual who wrote the foreword for my book. And his plateau was he grew up as a driller, and it took him 17 years to get his degree, his engineering degree. But he still saw himself as a driller. And when I came in contact with Marcel and he invited me to coach him, he was in an oil company executive position, but still related to himself. His self-image was that of a driller. And one of the things he had to smash or break through was his image of himself. And he needed to start to see and relate and accept that I'm an oil company executive, and I'm proud of that, and that's the role I'm going to start playing. And oil company executives lead, they don't drill. So that's one example. I'd say another one is a coach I worked with. Her name's Stephanie Qualls, and she, from the behavior system program type side of performance, was the best I've ever run into. She's extraordinary and outstanding. But she was a person who essentially thought all this stuff that I do and I talk about, love, care, and concern, and these five conditions, was a bunch of psychobabble. But for some reason, she sat down with me one day and she said, I can't deny the results you're producing. Help me understand and get what I don't seem to get. And we ended up working together for about 3 years. And she now totally is every bit as effective on what I call the self and social side of performance as she was the behavior and is on the behavior and self system side. And both those examples are people who were willing to look at themselves, have an inquiry about themselves, and develop themselves. It wasn't about give me some new tool or program or something like that. It's help me develop me.
Those are great examples. So, Cort, what's coming up for you in the near future? Your book is out. What else is about to happen?
Essentially, what I'm doing right now is I'm writing a second book. I'm looking for that next. I just ended a six-year engagement with a large corporation. I'm looking for that next leader out there who says, hey, I want to sign up with someone like this guy, and I want to become this type of leader, and I want to produce a performance in my organization that he's describing. And then the other thing I've just begun is I'm now turning around and teaching others how to do what I do. So I have these very exclusive summits where people come to Austin, very small groups, and spend an entire week with me. And essentially, I give them everything I have, everything from my experience and my knowledge and my process and approach, but all of my materials and everything. And the idea is they can go out and start doing what I do.
Sounds great. How can listeners learn more about you and follow you?
It's very simple. Just go to courtdial.com, and court is C-O-R-T, dial, D-I-A-L.com /smashingtheplateau. And you can learn all about me and everything I do and offer.
Sounds great. Well, Court, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today on Smashing the Plateau. It's been a really great discussion about what happens when you become an all-in leader. So thanks for coming on. Thanks for sharing a little bit about your own story and what you've seen in your career. My guest today has been Court Dial, president of Court Dial Consulting. Thank you again, Court, for joining us.
Thank you, David. I enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Smashing the Plateau, the podcast produced by Tend Strategic Partners. I hope you enjoyed our discussion. Have you ever hit a plateau in your own life or career? If so, let's talk. It would be my pleasure to take you through one of our free half-hour discovery sessions, where we'll get to the bottom of what might be keeping you stuck and how to move things forward. Just give me a call at 212-731-0770. That's 212-731-0770. You never know what you might find out.